Hello, BBC Radio 4. What are you thinking about right now?
The sort of innate nature of human beings.
Well, I'm looking outside. I'm looking, does it look like it's going to rain? Is it sunny?
In a new series, the psychologist Professor Steven Pinker wants to get you thinking about thinking.
From law, medicine, and forecasting to sports, climate, and conspiracy theories, I'll explore how we make judgments and often misjudgments.
I would have twice as many billions if I just made a different decision.
Think with Pinker begins this Thursday afternoon at 4 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
We're heading to Ambridge in half an hour. First on Radio 4, time to take down the dust covers, unlock the gift shop and push open the doors of that repository of all things peculiar.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Southampton Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, where each week we accept new donations. Like a charity shop, really, but with more plinths, fewer coat hangers and no shoes in the window. And here to cough disapprovingly if anyone touches the displays is our curator, Holly Walsh.
Hello, John.
Hello, Holly. What's new in the museum?
Well, Professor, this week I've been working on the Too Much Information desk.
Ah, and how does that differ from our usual information desk?
Well, when people come up and ask where the cafe is or what time we shut, I like to deliver a 40-minute lecture on the history of the Flemish lace-weaving industry or the properties of dark matter.
Well, that must be keeping you busy.
Yeah, you're right about that. I haven't been to the loo since Tuesday.
Oh, that really is too much information. Well, now let's meet today's champion steering committee. Comedian and champion debater Catherine Bohart, novelist and champion podcaster Elizabeth Day, and airline captain, Iron Maiden frontman and champion fencer Bruce Dickinson. Hello.
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 So, Bruce, you've travelled the world with Iron Maiden. Do you get a lot of time in between gigs to sort of pop off and go to a museum?
Well, I mean, at my age, I do sometimes think about popping off, but not usually to a museum. But yeah, occasionally we have a wander around because I'm a bit of an anorak about aeroplanes. So I go and find ancient aeroplane museums with ancient aeroplanes and a lot of ancient people to go with them who are normally quite happy to sit there and tell stories all day long.
So, Catherine, what kind of museums do you like to hang out in?
I will say that my favourite part of a museum is not the museum.
Oh.
Is it the gift shop?
I dare say it's a tight race between the cafe and the gift shop.
When you're in the cafe, what do you buy? Do you buy cake or soup?
Oh, cake.
Always
Who's buying
cake
museum soup?
That is actually a really good question, though.
Because you've got through the museum, so the cake is your reward. A bit of lemon drizzle.
No, Elizabeth, that's the secret. You don't have to go to the museum. You can go straight to the cafe.
I've been doing
no one stops you. No one's checking out. You don't have to do a quiz. You can go straight in. You can buy that cake without knowing anything. It's amazing.
Elizabeth, do you have any favourite museums?
I do, actually. I love the Newseum in Washington, D.C. And part of the reason I love that is because I adore a pun. And the Newseum is dedicated to journalism. And as a journalist myself, we're so accustomed to being vilified and criticised and having to deal with horrible online comments that to have an entire vast museum devoted to how great we are, it was just a lovely experience going around it for the first time.
Catherine, you were named the Times Comedy Face to Watch for 2019. You've appeared on Mock the Week, Roast Battle, House of Games, and The MASH Report. You co-hosted the BBC podcast about relationships, which was brilliantly titled You'll Do, have just launched your latest podcast, Trusty Hogs, and are about to head off on tour with your latest show, This Isn't For You. Now, there's plenty of topical stuff and satire on your CV. Do you ever get bored of the news?
I wish I could get bored of the news. What an absolute treat it would be one time to turn on the news and go, huh, not much there, bit dull. I feel, if anything, I'm like overly stimulated by the news constantly. And it's been a long time since we've been allowed to be bored by it. So no, but I perhaps sometimes should tune out of the news so that I could have a moment's peace.
Catherine, let me just ask you about your podcast, Trusty Hogs. What's that?
Oh, it's, listen, I think if you listen to this show, it might be one of the ones you might want to turn down volume wise if you switch over to ours. We are, it's a bit chaotic. We basically are agony ants who cause more trouble than we fix. But we have a great time doing it. I started an online show during lockdown called Gigless, and the podcast was born of that. I do.
Okay, so what's Gigless then? That's when you can't do a real life gig.
Yeah, so we ended up doing 72 online gigs during lockdown because we couldn't gig, and it turns out I still need attention. So I found a workaround, and that was a new material gig for comics. Obviously, that was something we couldn't do during lockdown. We couldn't really try out new jokes, and I think we needed it and audiences needed it. So it's quite a female-heavy, queer-heavy community, and the podcast is just some madness on top of that.
Has anyone here ever written to an agony aunt?
I wrote to Jim Will Fix It.
Did you?
A couple of times. Luckily, I never got on the show.
I don't love the association between that and Trusty Hogs. I'd like to distance myself from them.
Yes.
I think agony aunts fall into politicians, though. People who are agony aunts rarely, historically, have had any training in any sort of counselling or therapy, and yet have decided that they are the person to solve problems.
And it is exactly that blind optimism and arrogance with which we make our podcast.
When I was a student, I made quite a lot of money. I used to write into all those sort of women's magazines. They'd pay you 60 quid if they publish your letter. And there's a real formula to it. So I used to write in, and I remember when I wrote about how I lied and said I took my baby to the office with me and put her next to the photocopier, and the sound of the photocopier lulled her to sleep, and they sent me a check for 60 quid. The trouble was I always had to use different names, so they'd always send me checks in different names, so I could never cash it. So it was but I just took pride in being a published author.
Left my baby by the radiator and she's shrunk. Can I rehydrate her? You know what I mean?
Catherine, thank you so much. You're surely among Ireland's finest exports, right up there with Kerrygold butter and Tato crisps.
Surely not Tato, thank you.
And all have a place in our hearts, but in your case, it's more than just cholesterol. Coming to you now, Elizabeth, you're a novelist, podcaster, journalist and broadcaster, have just published your latest book, Magpie. You also present Open Book for Radio 4 and Sky Arts Book Club Live, were a judge for this year's Women's Prize for Fiction, and your smash hit podcast, How to Fail, has had over 20 million downloads. Did you ever worry that that title was tempting fate?
I actually didn't. I thought that it would enable me to fail and still be on brand. So that was the idea behind it.
That's very good.
I'm now in my 13th season, so I've had everyone from Phoebe Waller-Bridge to Gloria Steinem to Graham Norton, and I recently had Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who was one of my dream guests when I started out. So it's been, I mean, no one's more surprised than I am, John. But it came out of my own failures, really. You know, professionally speaking, in my 30s, things, on paper at least, seemed to be going according to plan, in that I'd published the first of my books and I was a Sunday newspaper feature writer. But personally speaking, it was a different story, and I sort of got divorced and I had unsuccessful fertility treatment, and then another relationship breakup happened 3 weeks before my 39th birthday.
Ooh.
And I was just left feeling like I didn't have the answers to how to live life how I was meant to. And so really it came out of my own preoccupations. I wanted to ask people who were cleverer and more experienced than I was, and also who had different kinds of lives from the ones that I did, what they thought about failure, and also, crucially, what they learned from it. So I think that surviving failure can often teach you necessary lessons, and that's where it started. It's been one of the greatest but most unexpected gifts of my life to find that it resonates with so many other people.
That's so moving, because it's certainly what I think is that you learn pretty much nothing from success. You only learn from failure. And successful people are simply those who keep getting back on the horse. You know, I'm a very stubborn, and I would say my life's been 75% failure. But it's just you keep going. You don't take failure as an end to things.
And that's the thing that I always say, you know, failure happens to us all. It is a fact of life.
Yeah.
We can't spend our life trying to avoid it, because then we're going to avoid the opportunity to grow and evolve. And once you realise that it's a fact of life, you also realise, I think, that how you respond to it, that's what's within your control. Not the fact of failure itself, but how you respond to it, which is a test of your character.
Well, I totally agree. It's, I mean, shit happens and all you really have is your attitude, isn't it?
Exactly, it's all data acquisition.
Catherine, let's ask you, have anything ever gone wrong in your life?
And no, everything's been perfect.
I thought so. Bruce, moving on to you then. Finally, Elizabeth, you wrote your latest novel, Magpie, during the first lockdown, and it has absolutely soared into the Sunday Times bestseller list. I mean, was it hard to write or did it flow out of you?
It was both hard and the only thing I could do, in a way. I found it difficult primarily because I normally like to write in cafes because I like being surrounded by the murmur of other people, and writing can be relatively solitary and the only person you speak to is the security guard at the local supermarket. So I struggled not being able to go to a cafe, but then I discovered coffee shop ambient sounds on YouTube, which was honestly amazing. And I used to have this kind of golden hour every day because my diary, like everyone else's, cleared. I was able to choose when I wanted to write. And I used to write from 5 to 7pm. I'd listen to my coffee shop ambient sounds. And I found it really therapeutic, actually. And there are a lot of quite personal themes in Magpie. And it was a really good way of exorcising them.
It described in the bookseller as a thrilling, stylish and psychologically astute story of jealousy, motherhood and power. That's pretty tasty, isn't it?
A fun read for the beach.
Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. Your books are like fine wines, invariably found amongst the best sellers. Well, now over to you, Bruce. You're, of course, the lead singer of legendary band Iron Maiden, who've performed over 2,000 times in more than 60 countries, released 17 studio albums and sold over 100 million records. You're a professional airline pilot, you've had your own radio show on Six Music, and you're an honorary citizen of Sarajevo. I mean, wow. Were you born with a heavy metal spoon in your mouth?
Lead. It's lead, actually.
How did it all start? Did it start well? Did you have a good beginning in life?
No, I mean, I was a bit of a surprise because my mum was 16, just about when I was born. And I was born at my granddad's house in Manton, in Worksop. He was a coal miner, went down the mines when he was 13. So I was born there, went to the local pit school. I lived with my granddad. Mm. The first thing I remember my parents, other than the occasional Sunday visit, was they whisked me away to Sheffield and said, "Hello, we're your parents." I went, "Since when?"
Oh, my goodness.
And then they worked really hard. And I was the first one of the family ever to go to a boarding school because they thought I'd be a dentist or a doctor. But to cut to the chase about what's it like being in Iron Maiden, because it's been part of my life ever since I started doing bands and things seriously at the middle of uni, it's not something I actually think about. I'll be honest with you. I worry about the recycling more than I do about being an Iron Maiden, you know, making sure I get the right things in the right bins and all the rest of it. I like to try and keep myself to myself when I'm on tour and be as anonymous and invisible as possible, because the visibility is what happens on stage. In my case, being the singer, you're also a bit of a lightning rod for the audience. You're a bit of a shamanic figure. They channel their stuff through you and you throw it back to them. I always say it's like having a balloon inside you. Mm. Imagine a balloon that would fill a gig. So you inflate this balloon that's inside you until it touches the corners of the gig. And then as you get more and more experienced, the gigs get bigger. And so your ability to inflate the balloon gets bigger. That's experience. Wow. That's presence. And you kind of learn it and you grow into it and you adapt it. The trouble is that, you know, now you come off stage, you've got a 100-foot balloon around you. You have to deflate the balloon. I mean, there's that great sound of flatulence as they down comes the balloon that was in front of 50,000 people. And you walk off stage and you go, "That was exhausting. It was this, it was that, it was brilliant, but it's not real." You know, it's real for everybody out there, but you have to make it come down. You have to get that thing down to a sensible size so you can go to sleep. I normally go and sit in a shower for about an hour after a gig. But it's brilliant. Honestly, it's brilliant. It's the most brilliant thing you can do. And at where I am now, it's a privilege really, to be able to do it. I mean, I'm just happy that my body's up to snuff and can still do it. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've loved hearing that. Thank you, Bruce. What an amazing way of explaining it.
You have answered my genuine question, which was about you being on tour in Iron Maiden, which is what's the hair upkeep?
Because the hair upkeep?
Yeah, because it's such a fundamental part of all of you. I was like, surely there's a regimen. I didn't realise it would be an hour-long shower, but I doubt that's why you do it. But I was like,
how do they have
such luscious locks?
No. My luscious locks have gone from basically zero to long, back to medium. When I was working as an airline pilot, they were short. So I used to take unpaid leave to go on tour with Iron Maiden. And in the rest of the time, I'd be flying holidaymakers to Sharm el-Sheikh.
But wait, when you were flying tourists to Sharm el-Sheikh, did you come on the kind of tannoy and say, this is your captain, Bruce Dickinson? And did anyone recognise your name and insist on meeting you?
No, but the reason for that is because nobody actually gives a stuff about what the pilot says. I mean, that's why, you know, whenever there is a depressurisation, you know, half the passengers have got the oxygen masks on and they all turn blue because they didn't listen to the bit that said, pull the mask towards you to start the flow of oxygen. You know, they missed that bit, you know.
I've got to mention your amazing one-man show, because there's still possibly you might just get some tickets in Edinburgh and Liverpool if you hurry. Thank you, Bruce. You once invited us all to run to the hills, but I think we'd all much rather stay here hanging out with you. And it's time once again to open the museum for donations. So, Madam Curator, I must ask, do you have a fanfare for us?
Of course, Professor. So my approach this week was to go a bit more baroque. You might have heard of a trumpet voluntary. Well, this is a trumpet involuntary, and it happens when you fall asleep on the sofa with a brass instrument in your mouth and you are suddenly rudely awakened by an unwelcome member of your family, and or you eat too many beans. You decide. So, I now declare the museum open for donations! One of my high points, I think. So, Catherine, what would you like to donate to the museum?
I would very much like to offer the museum a perfectly soft-boiled egg.
That is music to my ears. What is so special about a perfectly boiled soft egg?
I think eggs should just be in all museums. There should be more odes paid to them, really. I think they're the only breakfast I can have that make me as smug as going to the gym in the morning, which I think if a breakfast can do that and you can avoid the gym, that's incredible. But also, I don't know about you, but I always wake up to a cacophony of worry. I don't really need an alarm. I just have Irish guilt. And so I usually wake up with a brain that says, you're late for life. There's so much to do. Come on. And so I don't tend to eat breakfast in a conscious way, except if it's a boiled egg, because you have to give it your attention, don't you? It's like it demands of you your focus. And I love that about them.
What is the perfect level of boiled?
Oh, so it depends on whether or not I'm starting with cold or boiling water. But I would say you want it to run, obviously, but you want your whites cooked. So it's a tricky balance. But I would say if I was starting with boiling water in the pan, I would probably say 3.5 minutes. But if I was starting with cold, I'd go 6. But that's to get it to a soft boil. But I mean, the problem is it's greatly and hotly contested.
Are you a medium or a large egg person?
Large. I'm a bit of an egg snob. But I don't think I can even really give you a prescriptive. That's the thing. You sort of have to speak to your egg and your egg has to speak to you. I don't. Your pan, your
hob. It's intuitive.
Do you have a gas? Do you have electric? I can't tell you how to make your eggs. All I can say is there's perfect or there's imperfect and you'll know it when you see it.
There's failure and there's perfection. And
exactly.
To get to the perfection, you need to go through the failure.
Those are your only choices.
Great point, Holly. Thank you for making it.
Finally, Catherine, I'm a bit concerned about the odour issues of said egg in the museum. Do you think it's better to display next to our smell of coffee exhibit to embrace the breakfast theme, or should we put it with the fart donated by Matt Lucas to embrace, you know, the stink?
I don't know if you do cross-exhibit, because I think it might go well with the fart. If you don't have a chicken in the museum already, it kind of is a nice firm answer.
Or do you put the egg in the first room and then it goes through to a chicken exhibit?
Very
or do you put the chicken
hard to know.
And then goes through to the egg?
Very hard to know. But I think it'd be quite nice if you had any soldiers in as well. You could put it in that room.
Yeah.
But I do think you'd have to make a decision about how to replace the egg nightly. And I think it's either you go stealth, a bit like, I think, like a mom replacing a goldfish, or you make it a thing and you do it like a changing of the guard, like that'd a big a
changing of the egg
with some of
Wouldn't
the soldiers.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah,
with the soldiers.
Yes.
Well, Catherine, a perfectly soft-boiled egg is a perfect addition to the museum, where it will stand as a memorial, having been the last resting place of so many soldiers.
Bruce, what would you like to give the museum?
I'm going to donate a Bible. Actually, I have two here, and the one I'm going to donate... So I've got one, which was my great-uncle's. He got this Bible in Malta in, I'm probably guessing, about 1942, and he was in 200 Squadron, Royal Air Force. And there's lots of little bits in the Bible which are annotated, where obviously he was presumably getting bombs dropped on him and things like that, and they gave him great comfort. But then the next Bible I've got is the same Bible, but this one was given to me 31st of August, 08. To Bruce, with thanks for a safe journey home, blessings, Mike Elliott, Padre. And he was the Padre of the Royal Air Force Regiment. And I got that Bible. He stuck his head into the cockpit of a Boeing 757, of which I was the captain. And I was flying the RAF Regiment home from Cyprus. And before that, they'd been in Afghanistan. And tragically, they'd lost two or three members of their unit. So I flew them all home to their base, which at the time was RAF Wittering out in Cambridgeshire. And when we landed, all the wives and families and everybody were all out, literally just yards away from the runway when we were taxiing, with all, you know, placards, "Dad, you're my hero, welcome home, Daddy," and everything. And we had to stop taxiing because we were both in tears and we couldn't actually see. So we stopped, wiped our eyes, had a good blub, took a big deep breath and went, right, let's park the aeroplane. But it was very, very emotional. So, yes, so that Bible... I opened it up and I went, oh my God, this is the same little pocket-sized New Testament version that my great uncle was carrying around all those years ago. And there's an even more weird connection, because one of the frequent trips I used to do as an airline pilot was fly to Sierra Leone. And we would go there and we'd stay on the ground there for 3 or 4 days and we'd go wandering around Sierra Leone. And I discovered... only probably about 3 or 4 months ago, that 200 Squadron, Royal Air Force, after they were in Malta, went down to Sierra Leone. And they were based there. My great uncle was landing on the same runway that I landed on. He was staying in, well, he was a sergeant, so the sergeant's mess was down the road. We used to go down there, and that building was the sergeant's mess. We used to sit out there and watch the same sunset that he watched and sit and have a beer, probably watching the same ocean and the same everything. How weird is that connection, that all those things just happen in a circular fashion? I found it quite extraordinary.
It is an extraordinary story, Bruce. And here's another thing. Elizabeth's father was an RAF surgeon and based in Cyprus, which you flew
Goodness
from.
Goodness me. At RAF Akrotiri.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I know it very well.
Yeah, goodness me.
Did you live out there as a child then, Elizabeth?
No. So basically, my father was a surgeon for the NHS for many years, and we lived in Northern Ireland. I grew up just outside Derry, even though I didn't pick up the accent. And then when he left the NHS, he did a lot of surgery for Médecins Sans Frontières. And he also went to Sierra Leone, Bruce.
Oh.
And he's also a pilot. It's weird. Are you my dad?
Well, thank you, Bruce, for your precious RAF service Bible. You can be sure we'll take care of it and give it a well-deserved rest after all its adventures in the pulpit, the cockpit and the mosh pit.
So, Elizabeth, what exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I'd humbly like to offer the museum a red apple and a discarded hair extension.
What a combination.
Well. Because this is the donation that I think best represents one of the preeminent reality television franchises, The Real Housewives of New York.
Now, listen, I've got a question specifically about this. Why the New York version and not the original, which was the Orange County, or arguably the most famous, which is Beverly Hills? Why the New York?
Great question, Holly, and I'm glad you asked me it. So for my money, The Real Housewives of New York is wonderful on multiple levels. One is that all of the main cast members until quite recently, were 50 and above. Now, very rarely do you see women living their lives on primetime TV, age 50 and above. They've all been through disastrous relationships, bad marriages. They're single. They're trying to navigate this new world. It deals with so many different issues, from kind of widowhood to prosthetic legs to
the golden age of television.
Oh, Catherine,
that moment.
Wasn't it?
That moment. If there is a greater way to end an argument than taking your leg off and saying the only bit about me that's fake is this, in a restaurant, no less. Oh, stunning.
We are so on the same wavelength. And what Catherine's referring to is an iconic argument scene in The Real Housewives of New York featuring Aviva, who did have a prosthetic leg and did indeed end an argument in that way, because there's just no comeback after that. And I choose it because I genuinely think that it is some of the best television available. It's unscripted, and I find it completely compelling. And some of the speeches, some of the dialogue is Emmy-worthy. And the reason I choose New York over Orange County is because Orange County's got a bit Trumpian. It's really gone off the boil. But it did start with Orange County, you're right, Holly, and it started actually as a fly-on-the-wall documentary about this exclusive gated community. And then a brilliant young producer called Andy Cohen found the tape sort of gathering dust somewhere and managed to salvage it and cut together all the best bits. And that's how the Real Housewives franchise was born. And as a viewer and as a novelist, I've got some of my best inspiration from watching The Real Housewives, because you see how these groups of women interact with each other. You see, yes, the ridiculous arguments, but you also see the solidarity, the way that friendships go through many phases. You see things that I wasn't seeing on scripted television, like infertility treatment. When I was going through IVF, the only place I saw that represented in a really real way was on The Housewives of Orange County with Megan King Edmonds. So that's why I actually think not only have I learned so much from it, not only did it save me during lockdown and provide the best entertainment ever, but also it is a story of our time. And that's why I think it's a worthy museum submission, because I think reality television is a specific kind of time capsule and says a lot about the era that we're living through, to the extent that, you know, America recently elected a reality TV star as president and Kim Kardashian's getting people off death row. So I feel like reality TV, for good or for bad, has had a massive influence on our world.
Elizabeth, thank you for inviting us into the world of The Real Housewives. The glamour, the luxury lifestyle. It's not so different to my own, to be honest. But I gave up on the hair extensions way back in the mid-90s. My armpits were just getting out of hand. So there we have it. The museum now has a perfectly soft-boiled egg and an apple and some flyaway hair and a flying Bible. I'd like to thank Catherine, Elizabeth and Bruce, and I leave you with this from legendary footballer, coach and broadcaster Ian St. John. I wouldn't be surprised if this game went all the way to the finish. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Holly Walsh. The donors were Catherine Bohart, Elizabeth Day and Bruce Dickinson. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Shepherd, Mike Turner, and Mandy Fenton and Lydia Meisen of QI. The producer was Anne Miller, and it was a BBC Studios production.
Tomorrow evening at 6:30, Jade Adams explores what it means to feel at home, why we leave, and why we often come back. Andrew Garfield stars as a composer desperate to succeed before